Case number 22-1681, Howard Linden versus City of Southfield, Michigan, et al. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Kamenek, you may proceed for the appellant.
Kamenek, I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case. I'd like to reserve, as you probably already know, 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, actually, my sheet says five.
This morning we altered it. I heard I could do that. Is that okay?
I probably just didn't get altered. That's fine. Of course, you could alter it.
I guess a casualty of Zoom a little bit, but if
yeah.
I may. So, in any event, the court is likely familiar with the facts of this case. This is the case involving Tamisha, whereby she had at a medical event, the Southfield EMS came, they examined her. At the end of the day, they stopped CPR, they called a doctor, and what happened from that point on is really what's going on in this case. They declared, after talking to Dr. Dar, they declared that she was dead. The family repeatedly gave indications and told the EMS personnel that there were indications that she was still alive. The Southfield police came and also gave the same indications. Notwithstanding, she was... After they talked to the doctor, she was declared deceased. She was then transported. A funeral director personnel came on site. Eventually, she was put into a body bag. She was also wrapped in a sheet. She was taken to the funeral home, and at that point in time, the embalmer unzipped the bag, and they found out that she was alive. She was gasping for air. Her eyes were wide open, it's obvious at that point she was alive. On the motion to dismiss, district court found that there was no state-created danger case, either pled or, if pled, plausibly pled, and that any amendment to so plead would be futile.
What do you, on the qualified immunity, don't you think it would be an extension of our case law to... suggests that the cases holding that stopping private parties from providing aid applied here, because those cases involved physical coercion on threat of arrest. They were telling the private divers, you can't go in the water, so we're physically stopping you. Whereas here, I take it your theory is somewhat to the effect of they just provided misleading information, and so they didn't physically stop any type of private aid. They just provided statements that led the family members to think that private aid would be futile. And so when we think of clearly established law for qualified immunity purposes, I wonder if that is an extension that at least for qualified immunity would not be appropriate.
Depends on, as you know, I'm going to say this, it depends on the level of the contour of the right as you define it. And I'm suggesting the court, as we have briefed, that that's a level too deep, so to speak, a level too specific. And we also have,
hasn't the Supreme Court told us that we have to be very specific for clearly established?
To be very specific, but I would suggest to the court that that's kind of a sliding scale given the egregiousness of the conduct. So if you take the cases of which the district court talked about, those are cases of omission. And to some extent, in the case you're talking about, Your Honor, Beck, I don't even think that the private divers attempted to go into the water. I think that there was the policy whereby they said you've got to get approval of the sheriff before any private divers can be used. So there wasn't even an attempt that was made here.
Well, didn't the mom, I thought the mom at least tried to get in, and there was a threatened arrest
into
the water and back.
I don't recall. Okay. I don't recall if...
But you would agree, at least, that it is a distinction between a physical prohibition on an activity of private aid, in which case you could say, yeah, if you're going to stop private people from helping, then you do... obtain a duty to provide the aid versus just providing what turned out to be false information to the private people. I think that you may be right as a matter of constitutional law, but it's not clear to me why it would be clearly established from a case that says when you stop private aid, you have to provide the aid yourself. They never stopped private aid. They just suggested that it would be futile.
Well, they never stopped private aid. I would agree with that. They physically, your point, they never physically stopped anybody. There's no question about that. That's the way both the Second Amendment complaint reads and the Third, and I would agree with that.
And they also didn't do that by show of authority, for example. They didn't say, don't go, or you're not permitted to go get, or you're not permitted to aid, you're not permitted to get private aid. So it wasn't either physical or by show of authority. It was just misleading information.
Well,
it won't be helpful if you try.
Well, show of authority, you can define that different ways. Here is somebody coming from the city. They do have authority. They do have contact with the doctor. They are wearing the appropriate uniforms that suggest that they do have authority. They're in a municipal, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But were they saying, you may not aid, you may not help, in the same way as in Beck, which was physically keeping somebody from going in the water, or saying, you may not enter the water?
But again, in Beck, my understanding is that there was a policy in place that prevented the private divers from going into the water unless they got permission from the sheriff. All I'm saying here is that you've got egregious conduct well beyond what you had in Beck, at least by way of the allegations. You have allegations here saying that they knew, essentially knowing, saying that they told the doctor information to get permission to discontinue, and they'd already discontinued the CPR for 5 or 6 minutes, to discontinue any other aid. They had information before them indicating electronically that there were electrical impulses, that there was a heartbeat, and that conduct in and of itself raises this above a case where somebody has some sort of omission. Now, I also want to argue and want to make clear that this is also a case where it happened repeatedly. When the sheriff comes in from Southfield and says, wait a minute, she's alive. And they say, no, she's not. It's a fine line. I understand the distinction the court is making, but my best answer to you is going back to the original answer. I think that goes a level too deep on defining the clearly established.
So how would you define the clearly established rule then? That would cover this case from Beck.
Well, you start with the proposition that state-created danger is acknowledged in all the circuits. Okay, we've got that. And also, almost all the circuits I saw, including the circuit, as evidenced by Beck, have situations where somebody is, aid is discontinued, so to speak. I think that's enough, and then you factor it in from there.
What do you think? It's not clear to me that this is a state-created danger case. I guess I'll ask both sides. If the way I think about a state-created danger case, it's about a failure to protect. So some private party is providing harm. But here, I suppose you would say the failure to provide medical care and the harm is just the medical condition. That would not be enough because that would be like DeShaney. But if there were allegations of, say, intentionally suffocating as you were providing aid because you wanted to further the death of a victim, I would think that would just naturally fit within the state is the one depriving the victim of life, I suppose, in that hypothetical. So I wonder, is it even right to think that this fits within the state-created danger doctrine if you're actually alleging that the harm arose not from some private party, but from the state actors themselves?
Well, our primary position is the harm did result from the private actors. So
it would be the later in time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm interrupting. I don't mean to.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I acknowledge that for state-created danger, the injury has to result from the activities of a private person. And I think that's your point, if I may.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Here, what we contend was alleged, and I know that's a debate in this case, but I've briefed it, is that the state-created danger was that once the defendants were done doing what they had done and made the misrepresentation to Dr. Dar, as alleged, because this is on a 12B6 motion, that from there you started the process of the funeral director coming in, wrapping the live person in a sheet, putting in a body bag, going ahead, transporting over to the funeral home. That's the danger. That's the harm. Now, can we have debates? And I know the law in the circuit that you have to show either, depending on what case you look, there was some affirmative act, or whether or not, in this case, Tamisha was in greater harm before or after. You can get into all of that as well. But I'm going to suggest to you that she was. It certainly didn't help her condition to be put in a body bag.
Yes,
and,
so,
and
so
she'll, I'm sorry.
Is that the cause? I mean, is the being put in the body bag the cause of her harm, which I assume the harm is the brain damage and the ultimate death?
The harm is also the experience she went through. If this was...
Let me ask you this question while we're talking about the harm that she went through. So does this claim survive? Like, is this a wrongful death claim under Michigan law? And wouldn't that be not for her injuries, but for suffering to her loved ones, her survivors? And didn't have, yeah, can you speak to that for a minute? I know you only have a little bit of time, but.
It's okay, fair enough. The Michigan statute is MCL 600. I can't remember the exact statute, but it also it has four delineated elements of damage, and then also under a recent case called Denny, you can get some economic damages. We're not talking about that here. Okay, but one of the delineated categories of damage is conscious pain and suffering. So here she is.
So she's under a wrongful death claim, which is not her own claim, but it's the claim of the survivors, they can get her pain and suffering before she died?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. As long as...
And you amended your complaint to add the wrongful death claim?
Well, our state law claims are dismissed without prejudice here.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm just under 1983, we look to the law of the state to determine whether the claim survives the death of the plaintiff. And so that's what I'm asking about.
Answer this last question. I know my time's up. Yes, there were two amendments before the amendment in question in the debate. The first one was to add the state law claims.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one dealt with the fact that by that point in time, Tamisha had passed away.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Callie Henderson on behalf of the defendants, the City of Southfield, and paramedics Michael Storms, Scott Rickard, and EMTs Jake Kroll and Phil Mulligan. And I believe the court has a good grasp on the issues in this case. I believe the district court and the magistrate judge both did a very thorough analysis of what's at the heart of this. And as Your Honor has just pointed out, there's a question as to whether this should even fall within the state-created danger doctrine. And
I think that is actually harder for you, because I can think of tons of hypotheticals where, so there's the state-created danger doctrine. It's a doctrine designed to hold the state liable when some private actor causes the harm. So that when I think about it in terms of the text of the 14th Amendment, it's depriving somebody of life or liberty. And when it's the private actor in this, Cheney, is the one who deprives the person of Joshua of liberty. But you can think of all sorts of hypotheticals where the state intentionally uses a private entity to harm a victim. And I would think that would just fall within our, like the car chase case, Lewis, where you just have to have the relevant mens rea. So if, suppose an officer finds maybe a person in an intoxicated state, does not like the person because they're back-talking or something, and intentionally drops them off on a freeway at dark night because the officer wants a private actor to run them over. I wouldn't say that falls within the state-created danger doctrine. I would just say under substantive due process, so you would ask if the relevant mens rea was there. And so you could view this, if they actually intentionally lied because they wanted the victim to die, that it would just not be the state-created danger. It would just be that Lewis case, the car chase case, and is the mens rea high enough? So how would you respond to those types of hypotheticals where the state actor uses the private actor as the vehicle in which the state actor causes harm?
Your Honor, I believe this circuit has recognized that the car chase scenario that you just posed as a second branch off of DeShaney in regards to the custody exception, where the individual in that case was taken into custody and then left on the side of the highway. And the question then arose, was that individual, the harm that person was exposed to increased based on the actions of the government actor in that situation? And those are commonly referred to as the custody exception, which also sometimes is a blend of the Eighth Amendment claims. But in that situation, the circuit has always required that the government take that person into custody. And this circuit has analyzed similar claims in regards to what occurred here. If we look at Jackson, the Jackson case that's discussed in the briefing, and held that these medical cases where someone is erroneously declared deceased don't fit within that exception, because no one is being taken into custody.
Okay, but what, suppose, let's use the facts of this case. I know it's not even the allegations, but assume the allegations were the EMT individuals, your clients, wanted the victim to die. And the way they brought that about was to lie to the family to say that she was already dead, because they wanted the private actor to put her in the body bag and to suffocate her. Now, so there would be no custody there, but I would think there's a pretty good argument that it's the state actor that is doing the harm, because their intent is to essentially murder the victim, and they do so through the conduit of the funeral facilities.
Yes, I believe there has been some discussion of a generic substantive due process right within this circuit. And I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, this circuit has always said, as Your Honor has referenced, that the mens rea requirement for such conduct would be extremely high, higher than deliberate indifference, which has been defined as knowingly, like recognizing a risk and knowingly disregarding that risk. Such that requirement, I'm not aware of a case that has met that requirement. I am not aware of a case holding that such conduct would meet that requirement, especially in terms of medical decision making.
The case I was thinking of was Lewis. It's actually the Supreme Court, and they said you would state a claim in the high-speed chase context. You're right, there was a very high mens rea. You had to show the intent to do harm. But they did leave open the idea that the reason why they picked such a high mens rea was because of the split-second decision-making that the officers had to undertake during a high-speed chase. And do you think that that type of mens rea would extend to this scenario? I suppose it's, in some respects, also an emergency because there's somebody in distress. But it does strike me that maybe that would be one data point for suggesting that it doesn't need to be that high, that deliberate indifference might be enough.
I would believe that the extremely high mens rea requirement should be applicable here, because it is very similar to an officer responding in a situation. These are individuals being called to a medical emergency that are responding very quickly to what's occurring. And to make such allegations, I think, should be required, where there's essentially an allegation that they wanted, as Your Honor suggested, this person to die, and they made deliberate choices to bring that about, given the parameters that we're dealing with, where this is, they're called to an unknown individual, and to suggest that they're making that determination in that moment, I do think fits the previous mens rea requirement described by the court, as you were referencing, such that that would need to be pled here. And I don't think we have any such allegations here that would meet that requirement, nor has this circuit recognized such a claim in this context, which is why I think this also cuts through very clearly to the qualified immunity analysis that was referenced earlier, such that any decision here that would impose, suggest that there could, that would impose liability, say that there was a violation, would be an extension of any of this court's prior doctrines, such that the clearly established prong would come into play here, and these individuals would be entitled to qualified immunity, because this court has never put any paramedic or EMT on notice that their conduct could have constitutional implications in this scenario. And I do believe that there was some misstatements in regards to the clearly established prong that I just want to make clear. In terms of clearly established law, it is, and I have seen no case law suggesting that there's a sliding scale based on the egregiousness of the conduct, as was suggested previously. The Supreme Court has been very clear as to the level of specificity that is required to provide government actors with notice in regards to their conduct. And in regards to the level of egregiousness, there have been cases, and the Supreme Court has said, that in the very rare case of very egregious conduct, that the constitutional violation may be obvious. I do not believe that is the case here, especially given this circuit's prior debate regarding whether a medic's conduct can amount to a violation. It is not, this is not the rare case of an obvious violation. And I do not believe any allegations in this case support that.
Why do you think Beck, setting aside qualified immunity, you might have good arguments there, but do you think Beck should be extended to this scenario? So the state prohibiting, as Judge Larson said, through kind of show of authority, that private aid versus the state making misrepresentations that lead the party not to seek private aid. Do you think that the 14th Amendment would justify that extension?
No, Your Honor.
So why not? I know you have qualified immunity, but why not?
I'm putting aside qualified immunity, and I think our brief addresses this, whether this court can address that or not, which I would urge this court to address the foundational principles of Beck and the Cheney exceptions themselves, because I do not believe that, number one, Beck has never been formally adopted by this court. It's an unpublished opinion, such that any extension of Beck, therefore, is an even further extension of the 14th Amendment. And I do not believe that that aligns with, sorry, Your Honor.
Beck doesn't strike me as, I mean, it's somewhat intuitive to say if the state is going to prohibit somebody from providing aid, that the state thereby obtains a duty to provide that aid itself. That doesn't strike me as extreme. That strikes me as quite logical. It's almost like the logic of DeShaney in distinguishing the prison cases is once you detain an individual, a custody exception, you obtain a duty to provide adequate care to the individual. That logic seems to fit naturally with Beck, which is you prohibited the individual from obtaining assistance, therefore you have a duty to provide the assistance. That seems to be a natural extension of the custody exception.
And Your Honor, to the extent I believe I understand what Your Honor is saying, and I would agree that it perhaps would be a natural extension of the custody exception. But in regards to when we're looking at this in terms of the 14th Amendment, in regards to where Beck arose, because Beck really arose out of the state-created danger doctrine as an alternative to that. But really, what Your Honor is advancing, I believe, is a different theory, which extends out of the 14th Amendment, which does, I think, align more so with the core principles of the 14th Amendment, which is to prevent the government from taking an action that deprives you of liberty, which I think the state-created danger doctrine and other theories really got away from that principle. So to that extent, I believe the foundations for that would really need to be explored, and I don't believe that has happened in this case, nor have such allegations been advanced, because I do believe that the 14th Amendment is intended to prevent the government from doing, as Your Honor suggested, from depriving individuals of their right to liberty, such that if we define that liberty interest properly, such that that would be private rescue or help when in need. And if the government was to take actions and adopt policies similar to Beck that actually prevented aid from being rendered in those situations, because Beck was truly about a policy that was adopted. It was a policy analysis. Then that might be a different avenue under the 14th Amendment that hasn't been pursued here.
Can I ask you the same question I asked appellant, just about the survivability, just to make sure that this claim survives? So under 1983, we look to state law to figure out whether the claim survives. And I'm just having a little trouble looking at the Michigan statute here. It says that claims for injury which resulted in death shall not be prosecuted after the death of the injured person, except pursuant to the next section. The next section seems to be the wrongful death.
Yes.
But does the wrongful death statute in Michigan allow for claims not for present suffering of the family and the survivors, but for Tamisha's suffering before she died?
Yes, Your Honor. It is my understanding that it does specifically allow for whatever claim Tamisha would have had to survive.
So that's still
under survives. Right. Under 1983, I believe, The law within the circuit is that the family's claims actually do not, whatever claims they have, are not permissible under 1983.
Those abate, but hers would survive.
Yes.
If you're
on the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Kamenak.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Judge Larson, I think you've got an answer to your question. The statute is 600.2922.
Okay, yes, I got it. Thank you.
And also, if I may, just under the state law claims in both the Second Amendment complaint and the Third Amendment complaint, which these claims were identical, it's found under paragraph 97. Sub G talks about conscious pain and suffering, if I may. And sub O talks about any other damages under Michigan's Wrongful Death Act.
Okay, perfect.
That answers the question.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't want to leave the podium without addressing the due process finding by the court, because we're edging into different theories or different variations of state-created dangers. One of the problems, difficulties I had with this case when I picked it up, is when you go to the district court opinion on deliberate indifference, you have one sentence by the judge just saying basically it's a Med-Mal case. You don't have any other analysis. There was no discovery allowed. It was a 12B6 motion in front of us. We don't know. We didn't take the depths of anybody. We didn't notice the depths of anybody. We don't know exactly what was going on there. But yet we still have these allegations of intentional conduct, willfully misrepresenting the state of the decedent, now the decedent. And I do think that at an absolute minimum, the finding on due process was totally premature. And again, the court isn't really given a lot of guidance on that.
Did you allege that the state actors, that the EMTs acted deliberately? I mean, I think you just said intentionally.
Well, we did both. It's in count two. Strike that, count one.
Well, what did you mean by that, though? Because the way I read the allegations, you certainly alleged deliberate indifference, but it was more they were deliberate indifferent to, like, the signs of life. Do you think that's the same as alleging intent to cause death?
Well, no, it's not the same. But earlier in the complaint, I don't have the exact paragraphs. I want to say 34 through 37, maybe up through 42, which are all incorporated in the first paragraph of that count, Your Honor. We've got the fact that they had signs that she was alive, and they consciously disregarded them. The wording in the complaint is willfully disregarded them. And when they called the doctor, they didn't tell them that. So, yes, I do think, and I know my time's running out, but I do think we allege that. And the fact that they willfully conveyed information to the doctor, I think, is evidence of, in part and parcel, of deliberate indifference to a serious medical need, due process claim that really wasn't resolved by the district court. I know my time's up. Thank you.
We appreciate the argument both of you've given, and we'll consider the case carefully. Thank you.
Thank you.